Welcome, everyone, to the Faith Recovery Podcast, where we're seeking to recover faith by recovering the faith. I'm Kent.
I'm Nathan.
And we're discussing Nathan's book, Essential Faith, The One Element.
One Element.
Faith is the one element necessary for life. You can buy the book on Amazon. Today, we're going to talk about Christ as the seed of Abraham, which, if you read the New Testament and you've read Paul's letters, you've heard Paul talk about Christ that way.
Yes.
Yeah. When you read about the seed of Abraham in the Old Testament, they weren't talking about Christ.
Right? Or they didn't know they were.
But Paul says that. Paul says they were. And Nathan says this is important.
I do.
For the gospel, for our faith. Okay? Because we're trying to, we're talking not just about like New Testament theology. We're talking about faith, like living the life of faith. Mm-hmm. Why does it matter?
Oh, it's good stuff.
What is it, and why does it matter?
Yeah. Or why is it the one element necessary for life? Come on, people. Right? I was just listening to some other podcasts on the way over, which is not us, but Veritas, and they have a lot of times they have these conversations on college campuses between believers and maybe who's from a different faith tradition or an unbeliever oftentimes, and usually people who are noted in their field, various scientific and academic enterprises, right? and this guy, so the unbeliever guy, what you notice in him, and the conversation, you know, can go a little bit into maybe a debate about what's true, but a lot of it is just a debate about what is necessary. You know, what is helpful. And to me, that it felt like the real difference is what we think we have a need for. You know, and there are, I think there are large swaths of people who maybe just never considered that they might have a need for something metaphysical.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that they're perfectly happy with just the phenomena that they can measure, and that's all they need in life. Mm-hmm. So, obviously there's some that maybe feel yearning for that, but just don't think it's real. I mean, I don't want to say everybody's a certain way, but when we talk about faith as an essential, or we talk about, as I do in the book, that the gospel, Paul's claim is that the gospel message, the story of Jesus' death for our sakes and resurrection, is the power of God, right? So why do more people not know they need it? You know, if it's essential, if it's the thing. You know, so let's just say that we've colonized Mars. Okay. And I go into business and I'm on Mars, and in my business model, what I think people need is let's just say that they need bananas, right? So, and I'm like, everybody needs bananas, and I'm trying to sell bananas. And the problem is that the only way to get bananas is to have them imported from Earth, and it takes 5 months for them to get there. And, you know, so everybody thinks, I don't want bananas. They're brown, you know. They're just not very, you know, it's not very appealing. Maybe they've never seen a yellow or green banana because, you know, there's just no way to keep them, or that they're frozen or whatever. Okay, so people don't really have, people aren't just sitting there wishing they had a banana most of the time, right? But now somebody else decides that, you know what, I want to go into the oxygen business. That I've invented a technology that actually condenses oxygen out of the, you know, the Martian atmosphere, whatever trace amounts, and I'm actually able to produce air that's roughly 12% oxygen, know? And, so I've got to stand on this side of the market, and you've got to stand on that side of the market. I'm selling brown bananas, and you're selling oxygen or breathable air. You know, which, now, which one of us needs to advertise?
Right. Definitely right. Bananas need right. advertising.
How much work do you need? You know, like, I've got to come up with good recipes for brown bananas if I want to stay in business.
Right. Yeah.
You know, I have to find a way to make them appealing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Boom. Right, yeah. Come on, dad joke.
Appealing. Yeah.
Appealing. Right. I had to justify the cost of importing them and dealing with their waste and everything in a Martian environment. Okay. Uh-huh. Whereas you have none of that. You don't have to advertise. Your ad spend is $0 and mine is a lot. Right. And I have a whole team, social media team, and I've got all the most beautiful people eating brown bananas and showing how they're really wonderful and they make your skin look great and everything. Right. I have to create a veneer, something to make it appealing. Now, when it comes to the Christian faith in America today, because that's really the only context I have, what is it more like?
Seems like there is some marketing going on. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. Like
billboards and big buildings and ads.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Services.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. So let's just say we go to a college campus.
Uh-huh.
And we have a show up, you know, a little, the booths and everything like they do. And on this side of it, we've got guaranteed internships and jobs.
Right.
Okay.
Right. Right.
In your field.
Right. Right. And on the other side, we have the power of God for salvation.
We have sell it all and, you know, or it, just whatever, right? We just say, come be a Christian.
Deny yourself. You know, follow me.
Say, come find the answer to life's big questions. We'll say.
Yeah.
Right. Come find meaning for life.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And so then we have all of the students, and they're in one of those little chutes, like they have cattle, right? And they're behind there in the corral, and then we go, and we open the door, right? And we got a camera, you know, looking down on the little open area there in the union, or you know, in that mall area. I'd say that's where it's at. And we open it up and we watch where they go.
Yeah, they don't make a beeline for meaning in life.
Right.
Jesus' meaning in life. They make a beeline for the jobs.
Why is that? You know.
Not a perceived need.
Mm-hmm. Right. So the case that I'm making in the book is that here's something that's essential, right? That faith is the one thing that's essential. That's what I contend for, okay? And so why is it that there's not all that much interest in it? Why is it that if the gospel is God's power to save, you know, if I were to say, let's look at AI now, right? AI is kind of a general phenomenon. You know, I was just thinking today, it's like, you know, I haven't really bothered to learn how to use it because honestly, I can't pinpoint exactly what it ought to be used for, and I don't really know where the edges of it are. It's hard for me to get a hold of something when I don't know.
Yeah. When it's for everything.
Right.
When it's going to do every job.
Right. Yeah. And its limitations or its abilities or, you know, what I need to be aware of, what I should ask it to do, what I shouldn't ask it to do. You know, I keep finding out new things that people have asked it to do. It's just, you know, someone drives up in a car and it's like, hey, nice car. And it's like, yeah, my AI made that for me. You know, it's like, wait, I didn't know it could make cars. You know, it's just like, we don't know. But I think to some degree that claiming that the gospel is God's power to salvation is kind of such a general thing that if we compare it to vocation, right? Because really, following Christ is the meta vocation. Everything else comes under it. We're asking people take on the vocation of vocations.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then, you know, come here first to our booth. And once you've fully accepted our goods and services, then you can go to the other booths.
Then you're prepared for the other stuff of life.
Right. If you go to the other booths first, then you're going to get the wrong booth. You know, you're there's no way of knowing you've picked the right booth or that having picked the wrong booth or picked a booth that, you know, 30 years from now, you're not going to be filled with regrets that you spent your whole life in a field and you still don't know why you were doing all those things every day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I came across a quote just the other day that said, how you're living is more important than what you do for a living.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the argument you're making. But people don't realize that they really need to figure out how they're living first mm-hmm. before they figure out what to do for a living.
Yeah. Well, and on top of that, what we're experiencing now is that there are a lot of people who accepted that meta vocation, but later found it hollow, or for whatever reason, were able to let go of it. So it's one thing to convince somebody that what you have is essential in the first place, if they are going on fine without it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's another thing for someone who's had the thing that you're claiming to be essential and then has given it up. Mm-hmm. You know, what does that say about whether it's essential or not, right?
Yeah.
And so that's kind of the concern that I take up in the book, is this phenomenon of kind of this massive defection from the Christian religion. And now we're so far on the back end of it that it's not so much people defecting, but now people being raised outside of it and things like that, you know, that we're moving toward a post-Christian America, which is, I think, okay in some ways, because
we kind of need a fresh start.
And a Christian nation speaks of a lot of negative things, mm-hmm. you know, where we're not keeping those realms separate, which we have to, which is a whole other conversation that we may do at some point, probably not part of, mm-hmm. it's not really something I describe in the book.
Listeners can go back and find conversations about that,
yes.
I'd say.
Mm-hmm. Yes, go back into our catalog, our deepening catalog of episodes. Mm-hmm. But at any rate, yeah. So that's the, I guess, to me, that's the greatest concern is, let's just say that you've had something that people thought was essential for a long time. So let's pick another example of something that has always seemed essential, and then all of a sudden it wasn't, right? Don't know a whole lot.
The kids today don't really get excited about driving like we did when we were kids.
Yeah, okay. So having a car.
Yeah. Like now you don't need to go across town to see your friends because you got your phone.
Right,
so yeah. It's not essential anymore.
Right. So that's probably a really good analogy, just given the effect the phone has had on religion as well. Uh-huh. So used to be, right? Everybody having a car was essential, right? Mm-hmm. Now everyone's, not everyone, but people are ditching a car. Or let's just say gasoline. Mm-hmm. You know, gasoline was an essential and now it's not. But so it was a perceived essential, let's mm-hmm. say. Mm-hmm. Okay. And then something happened that made it non-essential. Something shifted in society that made it non-essential. Right. So people didn't really have to advertise gasoline. People would, you know, gasoline as a product.
right.
You know, gasoline is kind of an assumed, especially in the convenience store business, you know. Mm-hmm. We have gasoline out there pretty much for cost, and then we have pizza inside and big gulps and stuff like that, you know, because we know you're coming to get gasoline, but we want to attach a whole other suite of
other non-essentials.
Yeah. Right. Okay. So yeah, non-essentials like food can't come on. is that what's happened to Christianity, to faith, or is it something else? So my contention in the book, and this gets to what you were saying initially about Christ being the seed of Abraham, but I want to begin with kind of a looking at life and the phenomenon of life, right? So wherever somebody might be, if they're, say, a believer, but they've watched their friends leave the faith, or maybe they're questioning whether this is all true, whether they are a parent who's concerned for their children or whatever it might be, right? A pastor who's just concerned for the direction of their congregation or the society in general, or maybe someone who life has beaten up and they are thinking, well, maybe there's something to this religion thing, you know? I mean, it tends to be that successful people, people who are at least perceived successful in their industry or whatever it is they're doing, probably don't have as much perceived need for the gospel as somebody who is maybe at a dead end in life, you know. So let's just say that this person's reached a dead end and things didn't pan out like they thought they should, or that they're subject to particular behaviors or something that they that are destroying them, but they can't get out of. You know, people who are people I would call the called, mm-hmm. you know, but they're wondering if there's something to this or if this is something important, because really the claims of Christianity are kind of zero sum. It's either everything or it's nothing. And, you know, we don't have any room for people who, and I get annoyed by appeals like, try Jesus. If that doesn't work, you can always leave, you know? Mm-hmm. It's just like, no, stop. You know, it's just like, mm-hmm. it's either everything or it's nothing. Okay. And, so how do we prove that it's everything, right? Or how do we account for the fact that people have decided it's nothing, mm-hmm. who've experienced it, who've maybe grown up in it, who are aware of it, who have gone through some sort of conversion experience, who've maybe even advocated publicly for it, people who've been in public ministry, what enables them to overcome all of the cognitive dissonance of leaving, you know, of reversing publicly made claims. How do they do that if this is essential? You know, because I'm making a claim it's essential. How is it that so many people have decided that not only is it not essential, but it's really not even valuable? And I'm not making the claim that it's just valuable. You know, mm-hmm. So how do we get to that place, right? And that's swinging back into the book that gets into this subsection in the book, saved how, right? So it's arranged as saved. From what, or, you know, and then saved how, and then saved why, right? And so my contention is that what has happened to the majority of people in the Christian faith throughout history, and I know this is a sweeping claim, and I don't know another way to make it, okay, is that the faith has been mishandled, okay? That it's not been used according to manufacturer specifications, you know, the instructions. And that when it is mishandled, then you get negative outcomes, and then you get a real good reason to leave, right? So that's my contention, is that, and I think probably the real value in the book is, number one, I try to show and set a verifiable outcome, right? Something that Christianity should do for the adherent, okay? So that I'm not making unfalsifiable claims about some metaphysical distant thing, right? Because I don't think, even if you really believe that, I don't think it's compelling enough to change someone's behavior. And if you have a faith that really doesn't change your behavior, then it doesn't matter which one you pick. Honestly, I don't care, you know, and nobody does. Nobody else does either. So it's got to have some kind of outcome. We got to be able to recognize the saved from the unsaved, frankly.
It's got to solve this world problems, real world, real life problems.
Right. And the ultimate problems, you know, not just micro, but in the macro, what are the big problems, or the big problem? Then the other thing is that, having made that claim, right? Because now we can verify whether it's working or not, right? Mm-hmm. We can say, yes, it's working, no, it's not, because we know what outcomes we're expecting. Okay. Mm-hmm. So the outcome would be freedom, right? And those who are free are saved, and we can recognize the free by how authentic they are, you know, really on the surface. And you can usually tell how authentic somebody is if you just watch them long enough. Mm-hmm. you'll see it, right? Mm-hmm. So now, how is it that Christianity can do that, right? How does it become essential? So if we understand that the outcome is freedom, here's what's gone wrong. You know, I can't think of an instance in my life where Christianity has not come with a set of prescriptive rules. And I mean, if somebody else can find something, then, you know, let me know. Or if it's in a place where it doesn't come with prescriptive rules, it's probably someplace where the gospel's not actually being preached, you know, in some uber liberal group where we don't necessarily even need to believe in Jesus, but, you know, then obviously that's not where we want to go.
And even in those cases, I guess at least the unwritten rules are that you need to be on the ideological left.
Right.
Like that's sort of the rules.
Sure. Well, and that's what's ironic is that the more, what I've experienced and seen is that the more liberal somebody's belief system is, the less room they have for redemption. And so they only have one way of dealing with dissent, and that's banishment or elimination of the other person, which is what makes extremely left-leaning ideologies very dangerous. And I think about the communist revolutions of the 20th century. So people who don't contribute are, they're waste in the system. You know, it's a systems approach. And so humans become kind of waste in the system. And that can certainly happen on the right as well in other ways and with other rationales. But at any rate, so my contention is that, and it's not just my contention, it's Paul's contention in his letters, is that when somebody begins to believe the gospel, when somebody believes the gospel, what they've done is that they have entered into an echelon of existence, right? So we think of grace as what traditionally, if you were going to define it, say from a common Protestant,
what people always say in churches is that it's God's riches at Christ's expense.
Yes.
All right. So what's that mean? Grace is forgiveness, and you get what you don't deserve, and it's also, I think, also commonly now understood as power for living.
I like it. Yeah. Power for living. Yeah. And I think all of that's true, you know. But what I think is maybe more helpful, because when we say power for living, right, I don't think it's power for all lifestyles. Let's say, you know, so you're not like, Lord, just help me get underneath that camera so that I can break into that building, you know, I got a testimony, you know,
how God helped me.
I was breaking into this office building last night, and I made it, you know, I made it all the way through, and all the cameras were on the fritz as I was walking through, and, you know, praise the Lord. Mm-hmm. Right. And so it's not necessarily just power for whatever it is I'm involved in. And that's, I think, a major misunderstanding, say, among some health and wealth folks. Right. Some people are like, you know, grace is this just big cache of God's blessings. And the more you acquire God's blessings materially, the more he's glorified. And so, you know, health and wealth.
Mm-hmm.
But that's because there's no moral implication to seeing grace as power for living. Power can be, you know, appropriated in any direction. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't necessarily define grace as well, I think, as maybe when I call it an echelon of existence. What I'm saying is that we enter a particular moral, spiritual, emotional, intellectual environment, and that environment is grace. Okay, so in saying that, what I'm saying is that if we envision the life of every person, the common existence of humans, right? Those born of women. So if you're in that category, which I guess there may be a few people now that aren't, but anyway. That's a whole other side conversation. If you're born of a man, anyway, if you're born of woman, then you are on a particular plane of existence from the time you're born.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And that plane of existence, as you know, babies, that's their job to figure out the rules of that plane of existence. Right. So my little granddaughter didn't understand gravity, still doesn't understand it great, you know. Mm-hmm.
She's learning.
But the fact that she didn't understand gravity is not a good thing, right? We have to be there to understand it for her. But then there's also the social rules, right? If you do this, then people are going to be upset. And if you do that, they aren't, right? Mm-hmm. There are the explicit rules. Don't climb on that or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. And existence is about learning these rules. Then we become adults, we learn other rules, right? Laws of the land, rules of the job, policies, procedures, appropriate behaviors, etiquette, all of these things. Okay, we are shaped by a world of rules, and that is the echelon that we live on, right? And mm-hmm. Paul would call that the elementary principles of the world. It's like there's no society around the world where these things, to some degree, are not a part of existence. It's just how it's our social physics, as I think my daughter said, you know, once, is that it's the rules of engagement, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And we've got books about that and everything, people teaching you how to navigate those, master those, control those, use those for your benefit. They are very powerful. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can sway whole multitudes of humans if you have command of these principles, mm-hmm. right? And yet, what grace is the echelon, the existence of those who are born again. Okay? So those who are born again now enter a different plane of existence that runs on different principles, mm-hmm. right? And these... Because by very definition, if you're on this, and what I would call a higher plane, because it must be in the sense that if we're being called toward God, right, we would say he's of a higher order than we are, right? So we're called to live on this heavenly plane, this kingdom of heaven. Mm-hmm. That is, and I think that the behavioral standard and the... principles, the rules, and everything that we could that we find and we encounter on that plane are summed up in the word grace. Okay, and that grace in this plane, it involves the kinds of things that you were mentioning about our receiving from God. Okay, on that plane of existence. So on that plane that we have ready access to. God's power for living, his favor, his acceptance, receiving what we don't deserve, whatever, right? But by its very definition, grace doesn't ask whether someone deserves a thing. That's down on this other plane, mm-hmm. right? Whether someone deserves a thing doesn't come up in the realm of grace, mm-hmm. okay? And yet in that realm, we have to also conform to the same standard. We have to behave from the same drives. Is that so? My actions are not ones that are either right or wrong. I've left that behind. I'm only asking, is it gracious? Am I behaving graciously now? Right? And so I quit asking whether this person deserves it. I'm not keeping account. Okay. I'm only coming from a place of somebody who all of my needs are supplied a priori. And because of that, all of my behaviors can be for the sake of what's best, right? And so now I am functioning in a totally different way. I have a totally different standard for living, okay? So when somebody is living in the grace of Christ, they ought to have an ongoing witness, if you will, right? That their life ought to look, it's polarized so that that person can be seen as someone who is, what would be the word, more recent word, would, and I think this is related to the word grace, magnanimous. Mm-hmm. You know, that they're seen that way. Now, whether they're a working in a rice field in the third world, whether they're eking out existence in a tribe in Africa, whether wherever they are, they're magnanimous. Mm-hmm. I've read some stories about people who were, say, in a gulag or, you know,
these Nazi concentration camp,
things like that, right? Where the resources were very scarce. And so the question of everybody who's born of woman, right? Is and this is good people. I wouldn't say everybody. So the bad people who are born of woman are, how can I get more than you? How can I best you? How can I, you know, promote myself? How can I climb above the press of ordinary humankind? So Nietzsche would call it the will to power, right? Mm-hmm. So I would call that's the drive of the evil man, okay? So let's forget about the evil man, because we know that nobody listening to this podcast or any debate we meet today is one of those people, right? But let's say that the ordinary man, right? Or even the good man, right? The righteous man here, that someone who would consider themselves righteous and that people would say, yeah, he's okay, you know? That they would say, okay, I don't want to take what's yours, but I don't want you to take what's mine either, right? I want to do what's fair. Again, so that's the man born of woman. And what he's saying is that, you know what, everyone is allotted a bowl of cabbage water soup and one piece of bread per day. And which means that when I receive my bowl of cabbage water soup and a piece of bread, I'm going to take that and accept it, sit down, eat it, and you'll eat yours. If you take mine, you've not only, you know, infringed on me, but you've broken a social contract and you've become the bad person and you deserve to suffer, right? So that's the way things work, whether you're in a concentration camp or not, okay? Now, the gracious person in the concentration camp, he needs his bowl of cabbage water soup and he needs his bread, right? If he's gonna continue living. But continuing living is not the ultimate goal of somebody who has the faith, right? Which is where we're gonna go. Now, that person is able, because they trust that they're really cared for by somebody ultimately, they're able to then go and give half of their piece of bread to somebody who's ill, you know, until that person's able to recover. Because that person now, there's a deficiency. What happens is, I mean, this whole idea of trying to make sure everything's fair for everybody works until something breaks down. And it always does, you know, until there's some sort of a disaster, a fire, somebody is laid off or whatever. Now there's a depression in this kind of even existence that we are hoping for. What are we to do, right? So the gracious person is always ready and able and eager, I would say even, to go to those places. They become the white blood cells of humankind. And that's what it means to live in the grace of Christ, with the assumption that their prayers are going to be answered should they later be in some dire need. And it's not necessarily, I'm not looking for reciprocity. Remember Jesus in his Sermon on the Mount's like, don't do things for people who can pay you back. I mean, that whole thing is predicated on the idea that he's calling us above this ordinary echelon. He's like, if you invite your friends, isn't that what everybody does, right? He's just saying, don't just do the thing everybody does. I'm calling you above that. I'm calling you to a gracious life. But the problem for most of us, I think, is that maybe we grab that, grasp that instinctively at first. You know, we really were all about it. But then what's always happened is that there are rules, you know. Someone's like, okay, congratulations, you're a Christian now, your sins have been forgiven, and now here's this book, read it, get to know it's what it says, follow it, this is, you know, it. And, you know, I challenge anybody to refute me on this. I'm making some sweeping claims, so reach out to us at Recover Faith, what is it, discussion at recoverfaith.org or com, and, you know, say something, right? Because here's been my experience, and I think if you were to ask the average evangelical, how should Christians live, what would they say, right? Do what the Bible says, right? Now, I'm not saying that we should not read the Bible or use the Bible, okay? But I'm saying that but that formulation is essentially legalism. I'm sorry, but it is, okay? And the problem with that is that we cannot live on the grace echelon and the law echelon. Paul says that in Galatians 5, right? If you want to be justified by, if you pick one law, if you have one law, you have to accept the whole system of law. You know, you can't return to that previous echelon to just go back and get your car keys. Mm-hmm. Once you're there, you're there. You're not in. Not that you can't go back into the echelon of grace. I think you can. He wouldn't have written the letter. Mm-hmm. But he says, if you want to be justified by the law, you've fallen from grace. You're severed from Christ. Mm-hmm. Right? It's not that. So if you're saying you've fallen from grace, what is that implying?
Oh, well, you've fallen from an echelon. You've fallen down to to a lower level.
Right, right. So he's created an echelon.
You're not living in grace if you're living by law.
Right. He's arranged grace as an echelon above law.
Uh-huh. Right. And it's either or.
It is. It is. You cannot, even one law, even, you know, one thing is to return to a system of law. You can't grab one law, you know, so let's take tithing. Right. And it's just famously not in the New Testament. I say famously, should be famous. Most people don't know that, I guess. But you've got people who are just that are just vehement on grace alone, faith alone, you know, and they're just like once saved, always saved. And, you know, you can't make works a test of righteousness and, you know, all this. Right. And you just press them and you say, OK, but if I pray the prayer with you now, and then later I go out and rob a bank, I'm still going to heaven? Yeah. Okay. If I decide to eat babies, still going to heaven? Maybe, you know, I mean, you know. Okay. But ideologically, they have to take it to the nth degree because they're very strong on that. And they're just saying, no, this is a transaction. It's done. You're saved. Forget it. Right. And they immediately are telling you, now God wants you to give a tenth of your income at church. How did that very staunch faith-based justification give birth to a tithing requirement? You know? Okay. Now, so here's bottom line. Do I need a bottom line yet? Not yet. Okay. Here's somewhere near the bottom line. Maybe it's a cynical approach, okay, but could it be that the command or the retention of the tithing command arose because, from a practical standpoint, we just need people to give, and we need to be able to budget on a regular giving to keep this organization flush with cash? Could it be that it arose from that drive? Mm-hmm. Is that drive the product of trust in God?
Well, it doesn't seem like it's trusting God if we're like, we got to figure out some way to manage the people and the organization. And so we're going to set up a rule, mm-hmm, to manage the people.
Yeah.
Get out of them what we need.
We have to, yeah. And we have to budget. We have to project, right? Because we're a business. We have employees. We have facilities. We have programs, things that we're offering, right? And, you know, I think the stakes go up for people in church leadership, because not only do they have to trust God with their own life, but they have to trust God with other people's lives, right? Mm-hmm. And maybe that's a bridge too far for some. You know, I think it was for Saul the king, Saul the son of Kish. Was a great guy. You know, when all he had to worry about was his dad's donkeys, he was a good guy. Now all of a sudden he's got to worry about the well-being of a nation. Not a good guy. Mm-hmm. You know, and it comes on slowly, insidiously. But what changed was, at one point, he had the luxury of faith, you know, and in some sort of very incipient childlike form. You know, he's in his father's house, his father's really responsible for everything. He can spend weeks chasing one little clutch of donkeys, you know, throughout the countryside. Very narrow focus, right? Not a whole lot to worry about in his life. And clearly a humble guy. But when you take somebody like, you know, like that, and then you say, man, because you're just so humble, but also handsome, tall, strong, you know, you didn't pick any of those things, but you seem a king-like material, you're a king now, right? That guy's going to buckle, right? He just buckles under the weight because he's missing the thing. And the thing is faith. So when I say faith is essential to really living, okay, because this life of the ordinary, It's inherently flawed. Everybody who has to manage this world and all of its principles and everything, right? What people don't realize is that every person who's living according to rules is vulnerable to corruption, and in fact are being corrupted. You know, that they may not realize it at the moment. Okay, that maybe they have a luxury of a good infrastructure and a good home life and plenty of opportunities, and so they don't realize just the savage, murderous beast that's living inside of them. You know. But if we really are reflective enough, you know, if we can really recognize that and begin to ask, you know, what, how am I different from, say, you know, this person in Nazi Germany, or maybe this person under a Somali regime, you know, or something else where they are, the expectations, the pressures, everything, or instead of being polite and successful, are now be brutal and vicious, right? What guarantees do I have that I would not become that person? And if so, then who am I really, right? So that all that to say is that if a person's living under this, in this echelon, the echelon they were born into, that they are essentially wicked, you know, that they really honestly don't, you know, if we think about eternal life as a possibility for somebody, do we want to keep those people around forever? You know, maybe, maybe not, you know, maybe there's some sort of a long rehab that those people can go into, and maybe they will. I mean, I think that end times are more complex than those people realize. But as far as those who are actually going to belong there, belong in an eternal existence, let's say, they are the kind of people who do not need to be watched, right? They are people who have this instinct to care for others, or to do well, to meet deficiencies, to they have a drive to give thanks and to glorify God for what they've received. That they're living in this, let's say, it's kind of substrate of generosity, right? They're just swimming around in generosity. They're both generous and they are receiving, okay? Which is why health and wealth is such an aberration, because it's just receiving. And that, again, it just doesn't work. So why do people leave it? It's because it's been mishandled, I believe. I believe that very few people have the opportunity to remain in a state of grace for more than a few days. And you know,
because the system,
otherwise,
right, because the gospel comes in and they taste it, and then but then the system hasn't been changed, the church system hasn't been changed,
right,
to be one of grace,
right. But the one who is, I think, in this state of grace, that they can't help but to prove the claims of the gospel, and but there's only one way. When we said law is the great way to get out of grace, faith is the only way to remain in grace. So when we say grace through faith, this isn't a theological formulation. It's a practical reality. Only those who bring this implicit trust with, you know, have this implicit trust can enter this echelon, okay? Now, how does one get that implicit trust?
And now we're finally at the seat of faith.
Now we are. We're back.
Oh, well, yeah, we only have a couple minutes here, but we'll continue it next
time. Yeah. Yeah. Part two. Remember that. Don't let me forget. Okay. So the seat of faith. Here's the thing. Throughout all of history, we couldn't count on anybody to be gracious, you know, from the time of the fall, right, where someone was given the opportunity to trust and to have everything they need, and because of that, to live in a state of grace. I mean, Adam was born into a state of grace. Remember, and that's what we want. We want people who are born into a state of grace. Everyone's born into a state of law, but
we want
Adam
to be
born
again,
right,
into a state of grace.
Adam was born the first time into a state of grace, right? And so was Eve. But he was also given the opportunity to forfeit that state of grace. And what caused the forfeiture was unbelief, right? So we know that to remain in the state of grace is to trust, because the generosity of grace, the experience of grace, is coming to me in a realm of time, okay? And in time, I'm experiencing events in sequence, right? And we famously have this ability to forget previous instances of generosity. And as we look ahead, we tend to wonder if we're going to be okay this time. Okay? So how do I remain in a state of grace? So Jesus, Peter walking on the water with Jesus is a illustration of a state of grace. Okay? Jesus is defying law to walk on something else. Right?
Yeah.
And Peter says, let me join you there. Isn't that what Christianity is?
Yeah.
Right? Let me join you in your echelon. Yeah. Right? In your experience. Jesus said, come on, man, you know, and so he comes out and he's walking on something, you know, I mean, yes, he's walking on water, quote unquote, you know, but, you know, that's a contradiction in terms, right? So he's walking on grace, I would say. What causes that to not work out?
Peter could get scared. He sees the wind and the waves and he loses faith.
You've held me up in the calm. But is that still going to work in the winds and the waves? And, you know, when the sea changes, because that's what seas do, right? And our lives are like seas that are always changing. And so it is faith that keeps us up, right? And what does Paul say when he's talking in Romans 14 about trusting your brother to grace? He is able. Christ is able to hold him up. Hold him up. What are we worried about? If my brother is eating meat and I think eating meat is wrong, what am I worried about for you, right? I'm worried about your going down, right?
That's, that's a good connection.
Yeah.
But his faith is able to make him stand.
Right. So Peter doesn't have enough faith. Jesus does. How do we get that kind of faith into us? Paul would contend, and this is for next time, Paul would contend that the gospel is the vehicle for faith, right? So for saving faith, remember, not all faith is the same. And I think maybe that's what a lot of people miss who are critics of religion in general, Christianity specifically. I am a critic of religion in general. You know, that's fine. We can all bash religion all day, you know, and I understand that there's a lot of negative things about it. And I agree with many of the critiques. But what I think most people miss, even Christians, is that, you know, faith and belief are not the same thing, and that what most other religions call faith has very little resemblance to the saving faith described in the New Testament, okay, if not no resemblance at all.
The faith that saves us from the powers of this world.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. It so
and sets us free to live at a different echelon.
Right, yeah. And I think I've mentioned before, I had a conversation with a Muslim man, and he was a good guy and everything. He's trying to convert me. I'm trying to convert him. That's fine. That's fair. And, you know, I'm asking him questions because they don't believe in the fall, you know. So I'm asking, you know, and he says, everything's perfect. Look around. God's made everything perfect. I'm like, you know, what about people with disabilities? What about natural disasters? What about, you know? And he says, and his answer was always the same. That is your faith. And I'm like, what does that mean? You know, that faith is this stopgap, right? That so there was a survey done worldwide of people of retention, retention rates among belief systems. Okay. So atheists, parents, or, you know, who are raising their kids, what percentage of atheist parents raise lifelong atheist kids? What percentage of Christian parents raise lifelong Christian kids? What, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. What belief system do you think had the highest retention rate? Did I already tell you this one?
No, I don't know this one. Okay. But I'm guessing it's one of the hardcore religions like Islam or something. I'm guessing.
Yes, yes and no. It's Hinduism.
Hinduism, okay.
Yeah. Now, if you read much about Hinduism,
because that incorporates everything, right?
Well, maybe. Yeah, yeah. But I mean, if you, like, you read the Ramayana, right? So here's a guy, he's born, he's blue, he's super strong, his mom, you know, can't watch him all the time, so she ties him to a big boulder, but then he crawls off with it, you know. And then he makes friends with the monkey god, and or the, you know, Hanuman, and Hanuman has superpowers. He can grow to 50 feet tall, and the two of them team up to defeat the evil demon across the sea, who happens to also be Rama's mother-in-law, you know, which is good. You know, I mean, I think that's how people can buy in, right? But she's like this witch queen, and she's super powerful, and so that needs both of them to destroy her. And, you know, so that's Ramayana, and I'm probably getting some details wrong, but at any rate, you know, and this is in the third age. Okay. Now, you've heard that, right? Now, right. I know that there are things that stretch credulity in all religions, uh-huh. Okay? But if every religion, you know, so you're starving to death, how about some beef? No. You know, all the corn in your warehouse has been eaten by rats. Should we exterminate them? No.
Right. And how does this have the highest retention rate?
Right. What do you think?
Because of its conforming influence on society, like mm-hmm. if you abandon this, then you're outcast.
To be Indian is to be Hindu,
uh-huh.
right? Also, faith exists on a different plane. If you've ever seen the movie Life of Pi, it's a great window into Hindu faith. Okay, so in the Life of Pi, there's the movie. It's a story about how there's this guy survives a shipwreck, but he's on this lifeboat with several animals, you know, like a baboon mm-hmm. and a zebra and a lion and all these, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's a fantastical story about how these animals end up preying on one another. And at the end, he's the only one that survives. Okay. And the people interviewing him, the police are like, "It's insane, man. There's no way that's true." And then he tells another version of the story where he's on the life raft with people.
Mm-hmm.
And each of these people is similar to each of the animals that he's assigned. And the people end up, you know, basically killing each other. And he's the only one that survives. And they ask the guy which version is true, and he says, "Which version do you like better?"
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
That's faith. Okay.
Now wait, how
that's
is
Hindu faith?
Hindu faith.
Hindu faith is
right.
We know it didn't really happen. That's not the point. Okay. So it's completely resilient, like mm-hmm. you know, because it's not falsifiable in any mm-hmm. way. Why would you ever get rid of it? You know.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not the faith of Christianity. The faith of Christianity requires that we actually launch into the unknown, into each successive expectation of grace. You know, of an engagement with God, of an action by God, we can't predict. That usually comes later than we hope, you know, or, you know, in some way it's working to stretch our faith as well, right? That requires, you know, so to live in this echelon of grace, which is this disposition of I have plenty. We can't maintain that disposition where things are uncertain for us unless we have faith, right? You can't have grace without faith. So it's not a theological proposition. It's not arbitrary. It's not like, okay, you know, you want to come into, you know, into grace, let me see your faith ticket, you know. But it's axiomatically true. It's a spiritual law, right? So where does that kind of faith come from? Okay, I think that faith has existed throughout time in previous eras. It's been incredibly rare. So mm-hmm. Abraham, and I say in the book that God developed it in Abraham over 30 years. The Hebrews, you know, so after 1500 years, you know, we've got a few Jews who have it, right? When they go to Babylon and that's engaged. It's really not engaged until you get to Babylon, right? But these guys are like, "Oh, king, we don't need to answer you. We're not going to bow down to your idol. Our God is able to save us from the flames, but if not, know that we will not bow down." Okay, that is saving faith.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's faith that accesses grace,
mm-hmm.
right? But it's rare. But now what we are claiming is that there's a whole new race of people who are operating on that thing that maybe, so let's go Abraham, Joseph, David at times, not David at other times, mm-hmm. right? I'm just trying to think of biblical examples of this kind of faith, right? Daniel and his friends, that's about it. I'm done. Elijah at times maybe. But really, he's kind of an example of unfaith when it really, you know, when the rubber really hit the road. But anyway, so just a few. But now we're saying that there's a whole species of people, mm-hmm. and there's a whole kingdom of people who must operate in this way, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. How has that changed? How right. can we now count on that, the presence of that rare, rare, rare quality now just like gold in the streets.
Okay.
Right?
That's where we're going.
Streets of gold, man.
Okay. That's where we're going next time, and I think it'll have something to do with the faith of the sun.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, here we go. And we'll see you next time, folks. If you got questions or concerns, email us, discussion@recoveredfaith.org. Next week, to be continued.